Fangloy, ikaw na katulor ali fataga. Fangloy, ikaw na katulor ali fataga. Fangloy, ikaw na katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to this, the 97th of the Cthulhu Podcast. I'm FNH. Today we'll be starting off as usual with the next part of Through the Brazilian Wilderness. Then we'll have a 1926 number that features Louis Armstrong on the cornet. And then, for the main feature, it's part two of The Spawn of Dagon. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, part 57. On the following day we made 19 kilometres, the river twisting in every direction, but its general course running a little west of north. Once we stopped at a bee tree to get honey. The tree was a towering giant, of the kind called milk tree, because of a thick milky juice which runs freely from any cut. Our camaradas eagerly drank the white fluid that flowed from the wounds made by their axes. I tried it. The taste was not unpleasant, but it left a sticky feeling in the mouth. The helmsman of my boat, Louise, a powerful negro, chopped into the tree, balancing himself with springy ease on a slight scaffolding. The honey was in a hollow, and had been made by medium-sized stingless bees. At the mouth of the hollow they had built a curious entrance of their own, in the shape of a spout of wax about a foot long. At the opening the walls of the spout showed the wax formation, but elsewhere it had become in colour and texture indistinguishable from the bark of the tree. The honey was delicious, sweet, and yet with a tart flavour. The comb differed much from that of our honeybees. The honey cells were very large, and the brood cells, which were small, were in a single instead of a double row. By this tree I came across an example of genuine concealing coloration. A huge toad, the size of a bullfrog, was seated upright, not squatted flat, on a big rotten limb. It was absolutely motionless. The yellow-brown of its back and its dark sides exactly harmonized in color with the light and dark patches on the log. The color was as concealing here as in its natural surroundings, as is the color of our common wood frog among the dead leaves of our woods. When I stirred it up, it jumped to a small twig, catching hold with the discs of its fingertips and balancing itself with unexpected ease for so big a creature, and then hopped to the ground and again stood motionless. Evidently it trusted for safety to escaping observation. We saw some monkeys and fresh tapir sign, and Kermit shot a jacu for the pot. About 3 o'clock I was in the lead when the current began to run more quickly. We passed over one or two decided ripples, and then heard the roar of rapids ahead, while the stream began to race. We drove the canoe into the bank, and then went down a tapir trail, which led alongside the river to reconnoitre. A quarter of a mile's walk showed us that there were big rapids, down which the canoes cannot go, and we returned to the landing. All the canoes had gathered there, and Rondon, Lyra, Kermit all started down the stream to explore. They returned in an hour, with the information that the rapids continued for a long distance, with falls and steep pitches of broken water, and that the portage would take several days. We made camp just then above the rapids. Ants swarmed, and some of them bit savagely. Our men, in clearing away the forest for our tents, left several very tall and slender akashi palms. The bole of this palm is as straight as an arrow, and is crowned with delicate, graceful curved fronds. We'd come along the course of the river almost exactly 100 kilometres. It had twisted so that we were only about 55 kilometres north of our starting point. The rock was polyphritic. The 7th, 8th and 9th were spent in carrying the loads and dragging and floating the dugouts past the series of rapids at whose head we had stopped. The first day we shifted camp a kilometre and a half to the foot of the series of rapids. This was a charming and picturesque camp. It was at the edge of the river, where there was a little shallow bay with a beach of firm sand. In the water at the middle point of the beach stood a group of three burity palms, their great trunks rising like columns. Round the clearing in which our tent stood were several very big trees. Two of them were rubber trees. Kermit went downstream 5 or 6 kilometres, and returned having shot a jacko, and found that at the point which he had reached there was another rapids, almost a fall, which would necessitate our again dragging the canoes over a portage. Antonio, the Parasis, shot a big monkey. Of this I was glad, because portaging is hard work, and the men appreciated the meat. So far, Cherry had collected 60 birds on the Davida, all of them new to the collection, and some probably new to science. We saw the fresh sign of Paca, Agouti, and the small peccary, and Kermit with the dogs roused a tapir, which crossed the river right through the rapids, but no one got a shot at it. Except at one, or perhaps two points, a very big dugout, lightly loaded, could possibly run all these rapids. But even in such a canoe, it would be silly to make the attempt on an exploring expedition, where the loss of a canoe or of its contents mean disaster, and moreover, such a canoe could not be taken, for it would be impossible to drag it over the portages on the occasions when the portages do become inevitable. Our canoes would not have lived half a minute in the wild water. On the second day, the canoes and loads were brought down to the foot of the first rapids. Lyra cleared the path and laid logs for rollers, while Kermit dragged the dugouts up the bank from the water with block and tackle, with strain of rope and muscle. Then they joined forces, as over the uneven ground it needed the united strength of all their men to get the heavy dugouts along. Meanwhile, the colonel, with one attendant, measured the distance, and then went on a long hunt, but saw no game. I strolled down beside the river for a couple of miles, but also saw nothing. In the dense tropical forest of the Amazonian basin, hunting is very difficult, especially for men who are trying to pass through the country as rapidly as possible. On such a trip as ours, getting game is largely a matter of chance. On the following day, Lyra and Kermit brought down the canoes and loads, with hard labour, to the little beach by the Three Palms where our tents were pitched. Many pacovas grew round about. The men used their immense leaves, some of which were 12 feet long and 2.5 feet broad, to roof the flimsy shelters under which they hung their hammocks. I went into the woods, but in the tangle of vegetation it would have been a mere hazard had I seen any big animal. Generally the woods were silent and empty. Now and then little troops of birds of many kinds passed, woodhewers, ant thrushes, tanagers, flycatchers, as in the spring and fall similar troops of warblers, chickadees and nuthatches passed through our northern woods. On the rocks and on the great trees by the river grew beautiful white and lilac orchids, the cerberilla of sweet and delicate fragrance. For the moment my own book seemed a trifle heavy, and perhaps I would have found the day tedious if Kermit had not lent me the Oxford Book of French Verse. And now on to this week's music. As I said at the opening, it's from 1926, it's called Trouble in Mind, and features Louis Armstrong.
I'm gonna make my The sun's gonna shine in my back door someday.
And now on to the main feature. The Spawn of Dagon, Part 2. Elak found himself in a short corridor that ended in another black-slash-silver curtain. He moved forward, noticing with relief that the door remained open behind him. Beyond the silver curtain was a room huge, high-domed, with great open windows through which the chill night wind blew strongly. The room blazed with the coruscating brilliance of the glowing gems, which were set into walls and ceiling in bizarre arabesque patterns. Through one window, Elak saw the yellow globe of the moon, which was rising. Three archways, curtained, broke the smooth expanse of the farther wall. The chamber itself, richly furnished with rugs and silks and ornaments, was empty of occupants. Elak noiselessly covered the distance to the archways and peered through the curtain of the first. Blazing white light blinded him. He had a flashing, indistinct vision of tremendous forces, leashed cyclopeans straining mightily to burst the bonds that held them. Yet actually, he saw nothing, merely an empty room. But empty he knew that it was not. Power unimaginable surged from beyond the archway, shuddering through every atom of Elak's body. Glittering steel walls reflected his startled face. And on the floor, in the very centre of the room, he saw a small, mud-coloured stone. That was all. Yet the stone surged, a tide of power that made Elak drop the curtain and back away, his eyes wide with fear. Very quickly he turned to the next curtain and peered apprehensively beyond it. Here was a small room, cluttered with alembics, retorts, and other Zend magical paraphernalia. The pallid giant stood silently in a corner. On a low table was stretched the girl, still unconscious. Above her hovered the grey dwarf, a crystal vial in one hand. He tilted it. A drop fell. Elak heard Zen's harsh voice. A new servant, a new soul to serve me. When her soul is freed, I shall send it to Antares. There is a planet there where I've heard much sorcery exists. Mayhap I can learn a few more secrets. Elak turned to the last alcove. He lifted the curtain and saw a steep stairway. From it rose-red light blazed down. He remembered Gesri's words. Shatter the red sphere. His magic comes from it. Good. He'd break the sphere first, and then, with no magic to protect him, Zend would be easy prey. With a lithe bound, Elak began to mount the stairs. Behind him came a guttural cry. Elblis, Ishtar, Poseidon! Elak said hastily, protect me now. He was at the top of the staircase, in a high-domed room through which the moonlight crept from narrow windows. It was the room of the sphere. Glowing, shining with lambent rose-red radiance, the great sphere lay in a silver cradle, metallic tubes and wires trailing from it to vanish into the walls. Half as tall as Elak's body it was, its brilliance soft but hypnotically intense, and he stood for a moment motionless, staring. Behind him feet clattered on the stair. He turned, saw the pallid giant lumbering up. A livid scar circled the dead white neck. He had been right then. This was the criminal he had seen executed and brought back to life by Zen's necromancy. In the face of real danger, Elak forgot the gods and drew his rapier. Prayers he had found would not halt a dagger's blow or a strangler's hands. Without a sound, the giant sprang for Elak, who dodged under the great clutching paws and sent his rapier's point deep within the dead white breast. It bent dangerously. He whipped it out just in time to save it from snapping, and it sang shrilly as it vibrated. Elak's opponent seemed unhurt. Yet the rapier had pierced his heart. He bled not at all. The battle was not a long one, and it ended at a window. The two men went reeling and swaying around the room, ripping the wires and tubes from their places in the fury of their struggle. Abruptly the red light of the globe dimmed and went out. Simultaneously, Elak found the giant's cold arms go about his waist. Before they could tighten, he dropped. The moon peered in at a narrow window just beside him, and he flung himself desperately against the giant's legs, wrenching with all his strength, and the undead creature toppled. He came down as a tree falls, without striving to break the force of the impact. His hands went out clutchingly for Elak's throat, but Elak was shoving frantically at the white, cold, muscular body, forcing it out of the narrow window. It overbalanced, toppled, and fell. The giant made no outcry, and after a moment a heavy thud was audible. Elak got up and recovered his rapier, loudly thanking Ishtar for his deliverance. For, he thought, a little politeness costs nothing, and even though my own skill and not Ishtar's hand save me, one never knows. Two, there were other dangers to face, and if the gods are capricious, the goddesses are certainly even more so. A loud shriek from below made him go quickly down the stairway, rapier ready. Zend was running towards him, his grey face a mask of fear. The dwarf hesitated at the sight of him, spun about as a low rumble of voices came from nearby. At the foot of the stairway, Elak waited. From the passage by which Elak had entered the great room, a horde of nightmare beings spewed. In their van came Gesti, grey garments flapping, white face immobile as ever. Behind him, sheer horror squirmed and leaped and tumbled. With a shock of loathing, Elak remembered the whispering voices he had heard in the underground cavern, and knew now what manner of creatures had spoken thus. A race that had not sprung from human, or even earthly loins. Their faces were hideous staring masks, fish-like in contour, with parrot-like beaks and great staring eyes, covered with a filmy glaze. Their bodies were amorphous things, half-solid and half-gelatinous ooze, like the iridescent slime of jellyfish. Writhing tentacles sprouted irregularly from the ghastly bodies of the things. They were the offspring of no sane universe, and they came in a blasphemous hissing rush across the room. The rapier stabbed out vainly and clattered to the stones as Elak went down. He struggled futilely for a moment, hearing the harsh, agonized shrieks of the wizard. Cold tentacles were all about him, binding him in their constricting coils. Then suddenly the weight that held him helpless was gone. His legs and arms, he discovered, were tightly bound with cords. He fought vainly to escape, and then lay quietly. Beside him he saw the wizard lay tightly trussed. The nightmare beings were moving in an orderly rush towards the room in which Elak had sensed the surges of tremendous power, where lay the little brown stone. They vanished beyond the curtain, and beside Elak and the wizard there remained only Gesti. He stood looking down at the two, his white face immobile. "What treachery is this?" Elak asked, with no great hopefulness. "Set me free and give me my gold." But Gesti merely said, "You won't need it. You will die very soon." "Eh? Why?" "Fresh human blood is needed. That's why we didn't kill you or Zend. We need your blood. We'll be ready soon." An outburst of sibilant whispers came from beyond the silver drape. Elak said unsteadily, "What manner of demons are those?" The wizard gasped, "You are asking? Did you not know?" Gesti lifted gloved hands and removed his face. Elak bit his lips to choke back a scream. Now he knew why Gesti's face had seemed so immobile. It was a mask. Behind it were the parrot-like beak and the fish eyes Elak now knew all too well. The grey robe sloughed off. The gloves dropped from the limber tips of tentacles. From the horrible beak came the sibilant whisper of the monster. "Now you know whom you served." The thing that had called itself Gesti turned and progressed, that was the only way to describe it, its method of moving to the curtain behind which its fellows had vanished. It joined them. Zend was staring at Elak now. "You did not know? You served them, and yet you did not know?" "By Ishtar, no," Elak swore. "Do you think I'd have let those... What are they? What are they going to do?" "Roll over here," Zend commanded. "Maybe I can loosen your bonds." Elak obeyed, and the wizard's fingers worked deftly. "I doubt no human hands tied these knots, but..." "What are they?" Elak asked again. "Tell me before I go mad, thinking hell has loosed its legions on Atlantis." "They are the children of Dagon," Zend said. "Their dwelling place is in the great deeps of the ocean. Have you never heard of the unearthly ones who worship Dagon?" "Yes, but I never believed." "Oh, there's truth in the tale. Eons and unimaginable eons ago, before mankind existed on Earth, only the waters existed. There was no land. And from the slime there sprang up a race of beings which dwelt in the sunken abysses of the ocean, in human creatures that worshipped Dagon. He was their god. When eventually the waters receded, the great continents arose. These beings were driven down to the lowest depths. Their mighty kingdom that had once stretched from pole to pole was shrunken as the huge land masses lifted. Mankind came, but from whence I do not know, and civilizations arose. Hold still, these cursed knots!" "I don't understand all of that," Elak said, wincing as the wizard's nail dug into his wrist. "But go on." These things hate man, for they feel that man has surpassed their kingdom. Their greatest hope is to sink the continents again, so that the seas will roll over all the earth, and not a human being will survive. Their power will embrace the whole world, as it once did eons ago. They're not human, you see, and they worship Dagon. They want no other gods worshipped on earth. Ishtar, Dark Eblis, even Poseidon of their sunlit seas, they will achieve their desire now, here. Not if I get free, Alec said. How do the knots hold? They hold, the wizard said discouragedly. But one strand is loose. My fingers are raw. The red globe is broken? No, Alec said. Some cords were torn loose while I fought with your slave, and the light went out of it. Why? The gods be thanked, Zen said fervently. If I can repair the damage and light the globe again, the children of Dagon will die. That's the purpose of it. The rays it emits destroy their bodies, which are otherwise invulnerable, or almost so. If I hadn't had the globe, they'd have invaded my palace and killed me long ago. They have a tunnel under the cellars, Elec said. I see, but they dare not invade the place while the globe shone, for the light rays would have killed them. Ah, curse these knots! If they accomplish their purpose... What's that? Elec asked, but he had already guessed the answer. To sink Atlantis! This island continent would have gone down beneath the sea long ago if I hadn't pitted my magic and my science against that of the children of Dagon. They are masters of the earthquake, and Atlantis rests on a none too solid foundation. Their power is sufficient to sink Atlantis forever beneath the sea. But within that room, Zen nodded towards the curtain that hid the sea-bred horrors, in that room there is power far stronger than theirs. I have drawn strength from the stars and from cosmic sources beyond the universe. You know nothing of my power. It is enough, more than enough, to keep Atlantis steady on its foundation, impregnable against the attacks of Dagon's breed. They've destroyed other lands before Atlantis. Hot blood dripped down Elec's hands as the wizard tore at the cords. Aye, other lands. There were races that dwelt on Earth before man came. My powers have shown me a sunlit island that once reared far to the south, an island where dwelt a race of beings tall as trees, whose flesh was hard as stone, and whose shape was so strange you could scarcely comprehend it. The waters rose and covered that island, and its people died. I've seen a gigantic mountain that reared up from the wastes of tossing waters in Earth's youth, and in the towers and minarets that crowned its summit dwelt beings like sphinxes with their heads of beasts, and gods whose broad wings could not save them when the cataclysm came. For ruin came to destroy the city of the sphinxes, and it sank beneath the ocean, destroyed by the children of Dagon. And there was... Hold, Elec's breathless whisper halted the wizard's voice. Hold, I see rescue's end. Eh? The wizard screwed his head around until he too saw the short, ape-featured man who was running silently across the room, knife in hand. It was Lycon, whom Elec had left slumbering in the underground den of Gesti. The knife flashed, and Elec and Zend were free. Elec said swiftly, Up the stairs, wizard, repair your magic globe, since you say its light will kill these horrors, and we'll hold the stairway. Without a word, the grey dwarf sped silently up the steps and was gone. Elec turned to Lycon. How the devil? Lycon blinked wide blue eyes. I scarcely know, Elec. Only when you were carrying me out of the tavern and the soldier screamed and ran away, I saw something that made me so drunk I couldn't remember what it was. I remembered only a few minutes ago, back downstairs somewhere, a face that looked like a gargoyle's with terrible great beak and eyes like Midgard serpents. And I remembered I'd seen Gesti put a mask over that awful face just before you turned there in the alley. So I knew Gesti was probably a demon. And so you came here, Elec commented softly. Well, it's a good thing for me you did. What's the matter? Lycon's blue eyes were bulging. Is this your demon? The little man asked, pointing. Elec turned and smiled grimly. Facing him, her face puzzled and frightened, was the girl on whom Zend had been experimenting, the maiden whose soul he had been about to unleash to serve him when Elec had arrived. Her eyes were open now, velvet soft and dark, and her white body gleamed against the silver-black drape. Apparently she had awakened and had arisen from her hard couch. Elak's hand went up in a warning gesture, commanding silence. But it was too late. The girl said, Who are you? Zen kidnapped me. Are you come to set me free? Where? With a bound, Elec reached her, dragged her back, thrust her up the stairway, his rapier flashed in his hand. Over his shoulder, he cast a wolfish smile. If we live, you'll escape Zend and his magic, he told the girl. hearing an outburst of sibilant cries and the rushing murmur of the attacking horde. Yet he did not turn. "What's your name?" he asked. "Corelius." "Where, Elak?" Lycon shouted. Elak turned to see the little man's sword flash out, shearing a questing tentacle in two. The severed end dropped, writhing and coiling in hideous knots. The frightful devil masks of monsters glared into Elak's eyes. The children of Dagon came sweeping in a resistless rush, cold eyes glazed and glaring, tentacles questing, iridescent bodies shifting and pulsing like jelly. And Elak and Lycon and the girl, Corelius, were caught up by the fearful wave and forced back up the staircase. Snarling inarticulate curses, Lycon swung his sword, but it was caught and dragged from his hand by a muscular tentacle. Elak tried to shield Corelius with his body. He felt himself going down, smothering beneath the oppressive weight of the cold, hideous bodies that writhed and twisted with dreadful life. He struck out desperately and felt a hard, cold surface melting like snow beneath his hands. The weight that held him down was dissipating. The things were retreating, flowing back, racing and flopping and tumbling down the stairs, shrieking an insane, shrill cry. They blackened and melted into shapeless puddles of slime that trickled like a little grey stream down the stairway. Elak realized what had happened. A rose-red light was glowing in the air all about him. The wizard had repaired his magic globe, and the power of its rays was destroying the nightmare menace that had crept up from the deeps. In a heartbeat it was over. There was no trace of the horde that had attacked them. Grey puddles of ooze no more. Elak realized that he was cursing softly, and abruptly changed it to a prayer. With great earnestness he thanked Ishtar for his deliverance. Lycon recovered his sword and handed Elak his rapier. "What now?" he asked. "We're off. We're taking Corelius with us. There's no need to linger here. True, we helped the wizard, but we fought him first. He may remember that. There's no need to test his gratefulness, and we'd be fools to do it." He picked up the girl who had quietly fainted, and quickly followed Lycon down the steps. They hurried across the great room and into the depths of the corridor beyond. And 5 minutes later, they were sprawled at full length under a tree in one of Samu's numerous parks. Elak had snatched a silken robe from a balcony as he passed beneath, and the girl had draped it about her slim shoulders. The stars glittered frostily overhead, unconcerned with the fate of Atlantis, stars that would be shining thousands of years hence when Atlantis was not even a memory. No thought of this came to Elak now. He wiped his rapier with a tuft of grass, while Lycon, who had already cleaned his blade, stood up and, shading his eyes with his palm, peered across the park. He muttered something under his breath and set off at a steady lope. Elak stared after him. "Where's he going? There's a... By Ishtar! He's going in a grog shop, but he has no money. How?" A shock thought came to him, and he felt hastily in his wallet. Then he cursed. "The drunken little ape! When he slashed my bonds in the wizard's palace, he also stole my purse. I'll..." Elak sprang to his feet and took a stride forward. Soft arms gripped his leg. He looked down. "Eh?" "Let him go," the girl said, smiling. "He's earned his mead." "Yes, but what about me? I..." "Let him go." And ever after that, Lycon was to wonder why Elak never upbraided him about the stolen purse. That's all the story for today. So that's it. Except to remind you that the opening music is by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk